Blog Talk Radio.
Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited, YouTube at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited, or bookmark our website at moviegeeksunited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited. Welcome to Movie Geeks United this evening. We have an excellent show for you tonight, a live show. It's been a little while since we've actually done one of these live, Jerry. We've been doing pre-recorded.
I know. It's very exciting.
The pressure's on.
It's on enormously. I mean...
Yeah. Well, we've kind of spent like a month doing it pre-recorded. I mean, it gives us more flexibility kind of to have it exactly the way we want it. But,
right.
You know, you can't beat the excitement of live.
Right, true, where anything can happen.
Yeah, exactly. We have a great show tonight, very exciting lineup of conversation that we have in store for all of you movie geeks out there. A little bit later on in the show, our special events correspondent Dean Treadway will join us live from the New York Film Festival. He'll be delivering his first reports from the festival, including a review of Brian De Palma's latest.
Awesome.
Oh, I can't wait. Oh, De Palma. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. In future episodes, actually, we've booked a lot of great guests. We have Diane Ladd. We'll be airing Saturday, 3-time Oscar nominee Diane Ladd talking about her work with David Lynch for our Lynch series. We've got a special on the films of Alfred Hitchcock, a special on the films of Stephen King. We have composer Christopher Young, almost an hour-long interview with to talk about one of the great horror composers.
Right.
So we've got a lot of like horror-themed programming coming up, as is typical for our October
program. Yeah, for this time
of year, yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. February, not so much.
Yeah,
October, perfect.
Exactly.
But actually, we're starting it off right now, tonight, with our first guest. Carnival of Darkness is a great horror and sci-fi short film festival. It's in its third year. It takes place in Los Angeles. The festival itself takes place at the Los Angeles Film School. This year it happens on October 24th. The announcements on the films that have been selected to screen there was not scheduled to take place until, I think, 3 or so days from now.
Right.
But the producer of this festival, Mr. Alex Bram, he is with us, and he is giving us a tremendous treat. He is going to announce the finalists early, right here, live on our program.
Awesome.
I'm excited about this. So let me bring up Alex. Alex, hey, buddy, you with us?
Hey, everybody. Alex Bram here. Hello, reporting for duty.
Thank you so much for calling in. I know
you
called in a couple of years ago, and it was a great treat for us, and I appreciate you coming back to do this again.
Brian De Palma special, Alfred Hitchcock special, Christopher Young special. I am.
It is a good time to be a horror movie geek in particular.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, those are some of my favorites, and I'm excited about the return of De Palma as well.
Oh, yeah, we're crazed about De Palma here. Let me ask you this, first of all, to give a little setup for you and a little sense of how your love of horror got started. I mean, has it always been kind of an obsession to you, this genre?
It's probably a medical condition which could be cured by a medication regimen, but I've decided to become a horror director and writer instead.
Mm-hmm. So the festival is, of course, just an extension of your love of filmmaking in the genre.
Yeah, I'm a horror writer director myself. My film production company, actually relating to what you just mentioned, is called Panic Attack Films. So as a sort of shout out to the condition I suffer from, but
I hear you,
I'm making use of it somehow.
Yeah. So tell me, when you came on a couple of years ago, I think it was the first year of Carnival of Darkness. What was your initial conception of what you wanted that event to be, and how has it met and kind of exceeded your expectations in these years?
Because I started out with horror short films myself, I wanted to, first of all, I really like the idea of a horror short. It's kind of like a ghost story, if you think about it, is a quick little sort of, tale that gets right to it. And the horror short form is one that I started off in. And basically my goal was to shine a spotlight on those up-and-coming filmmakers that are working in the horror genre. One of my sort of secret agendas, though, is I want to sort of put forth the idea that horror is not sort of, junk or fast food, that horror can be art, horror can be, made with an attention to craft and quality, and most importantly, horror should scare you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what I'm looking at. I see hundreds of submissions from all across the world, and as I'm watching the films, I can pretty much very quickly tell whether this filmmaker knows how to do it or not. But there everyone has a camera these days. Everyone's making movies. A handful of these people should be making movies, and that's kind of it's those folks, those artists that I want to sort of highlight and present to the world.
Yeah, is there among the kind of the selections that you've looked at for this year's event? I know I hear from programmers at festivals like Sundance, and they say inevitably they'll get hundreds and thousands of entries, but there's always a theme that runs through a lot of them, and it changes from year to year. Like the filmmakers have one particular theme on their minds. Have you found that at all with the selections that you've viewed?
It is so true. It's kind of like a, cultural zeitgeist, I guess, and you're right. It kind of comes in waves, and you do start to see like a pattern, like, oh, this is one of those films, and you do start to see patterns. The things I actually pick are things that have managed to avoid falling into the traps of cliche and sort of cookie-cutter filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. But also what's great about horror, and we talk about this a lot on the show, I mean, you don't see it in drama. You obviously don't see much of it in comedy. You're more likely to see the kind of the real world and what scares us amongst the kind of the current events and a horror film above all other genres.
Yes.
Are there pieces that you've watched that have been timely in that sense?
Well, I just do think that horror and, for that matter, surrealism is more true and more reflective of a human being's life than a rom-com or even a dramatic, even a Jane Campion movie, let's say.
Right.
I find that these things, which are sort of, flights of fancy, but they tell the truth. you know, this is really what you know, this feels like. And I'm not talking about scary movie and popcorn crap. Again, that's out there and I'll go see it. But I'm interested in those movies like, you know, the Omen or The Exorcist or The Shining that have a lot of layers, not just a quick, you know, head decapitation.
Exactly, yeah. And there's something so kind of primal about the horror genre. And I like horror that isn't polished. I mean, I like it to feel primitive.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just me, but I just think that style fits very well for horror. But first of all, tell me about this event, and then we'll announce the finalists that have been chosen. You have it's beyond the screenings. You have panels and that sort of thing, correct?
We do. So we have it's October 24th at the LA Film School, and doors basically open at 7 p.m. We also are going to have a red carpet. We also are going to have some, you know, horror industry, sci-fi industry professionals and celebrities. So the red carpet's going to run from 7 to 8. Then we have our first block of films going from 8 to 9. And then at 9 p.m. we have a horror industry live panel. Our live panel this year has a couple of people. So Tara Cardinal, who's a horror screen queen. So we're going to get to hear from her. Then we're going to get to hear from Drew Daywalt. And Drew Daywalt was actually someone who was part of the last Carnival of Darkness, and he won an award at Carnival of Darkness.
Mm.
Since he was given, the name of the award is the Thrill Ride Award, and it's an award that we're going to give this year as well. Since receiving the Thrill Ride Award, so he had just been making short films actually for a few years. Actually, since the Thrill Ride Award, he went on to do a lot of other very exciting things, like working with George Romero, and he basically transitioned into the feature film world.
Wow.
Now, listen, let me be very clear. It's not because of the Thrill Ride Award, but what I like about his story is just for all these up-and-coming, you know, short film filmmakers that you can kind of, you know, it's not for nothing. It does lead to something. I mean, the same is with me as well. You know, I started off in short films, and now I'm working on features. So, and then also part of the live panel is Veronica Cartwright, film and stage legend. She's one of these actors that, you know, if you don't recognize the name right off the top of your head, she was in such seminal films as Alien, the original one. She had the sort of short, choppy blonde hair, Witches of Eastwick. Many, many other films. So she will be there as well. Very excited to have her.
Well, I believe that we spoke to Tara a couple of years ago, and we did a tribute to Veronica Cartwright a couple of years ago, too. So we're, like, right in line with your panel there, man.
Oh, that's great. I didn't even know that. That's great.
We're on board with it. That's a great panel. What's your favorite Veronica Cartwright film?
The other one. So I really love them all. I mean, Witches of Eastwick is one of my favorites, mm-hmm. blending horror elements and comedy successfully. Not easy.
Yeah.
And her performances are just always so committed. I mean, she just really leaves it on the table every time, you know. Of course, she's been doing it since. She was actually in The Birds. I don't know if you guys knew that.
Yeah.
Speaking of pitch
drops, that was her first movie.
What's that?
Yeah. I think that was her first movie.
Yeah. Actually, she was on Alfred Hitchcock's TV show before that as a tot, and then moved on to, I guess he, you know, liked her enough to, although she was an actor, you know, cattle, he invited her back to be in The Birds.
Well, I think of her in Alien, and you use the word committed. I mean, mm-hmm. she is like 110% committed in that movie. But I think my favorite movie of hers is actually Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the 78 version.
Oh, that's a good one, man. Yeah.
Oh,
my
gosh. That's just the best.
I love that film.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, these are all examples. As I watch the submissions, by the way, kind of one of my big sort of parameters is, am I being physically affected? Mm-hmm. Is my heart racing? Do I have goosies? You know, are the hairs standing up in the back of my neck? Physical? Am I having an actual physical reaction? Some of these films that I'm going to announce right now, I'm not kidding you. This isn't just hype bullshit. Can I say hype bullshit, by the way?
That's all right. Yeah, you can say whatever you want, man. That's cool.
Okay. Can I say beaver anal gland squeezing?
Well, all right.
At any rate, some of these films, as I was watching them, I kid you not, as I was watching them, I stood up and you know, I didn't, you know, by myself, I stood up out of my chair and I didn't cheer, but I was like, yes, because I was so excited about them.
All right, cool.
Because it's a shot in the arm for me to see that. You know, sometimes you go out and you go to the movie theaters and you're just pelted with all this. It's not even that they're bad, but it's just mediocrity. It's just a constant stream of mediocrity. And so when I see things that break out of that, it just gives me hope.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's a perfect segue to start announcing the finalists that will be screened there. Where do you want to start?
I will start at the top. These are in no particular order. I will just list off the film name and director.
Okay.
Are we ready?
I am all set.
Do we have my drum roll sound effect?
I wish we had. I just thought of that. I wish we had some build-up music. I'm so sorry.
I'll soldier on. Okay, here we go. Ready?
Yes.
So, first film short. And by the way, these are horror and sci-fi. I just started to get so much good sci-fi content that I opened it up a little bit. All right. First film called Things Fall Apart by Rob Chu. Amazing film. I have fallen in love with this film. Feed A by Clark Mayer. How to Kill Your Clone by Jack McWilliams. And that, you're chuckling, is a comedy. Is a dark horror comedy, but really, really funny, really good. Chameleon by Samuel Lindberg. The Hike by Walter Bost. The Gift by Carl Rich. This thing is going to knock your socks off. It was filmed in Russia, and it's just crazy. It's crazy. Many Doors of Albert Weil, that actually stars Tara Cardinale.
Wow.
The Captured Bird by Jovanka Vukovic. I hope I pronounced that right. She actually, her film, she has an interesting history. She used to be the editor of Rue Morgue magazine.
And this short
was executive produced by Guillermo del Toro. So she had a little bit of help.
Wow, that's a good pedigree.
You can't ask for better. I mean, wow.
Right, that's a real good one. Blue Hole by Eric Gardner. Some of these, this film is so scary. Behind You by Benjamin Freeburger. The Guest by Brian Ryan. This is an example of a film where the acting was so amazing. And so, again, there's an actress in this called Alicia Osh, and she's just unbelievable. And like, you know, we were talking with Veronica Cartwright, leaves it all on the table in her performance. I found, you know, the films that I have to reject, oftentimes it's due to acting. So, real important to have good actors. Two more. Welcome to Hoxford. And finally, something called The Immersive Cocoon, which is a sequel to 2001 The Stanley Kubrick film. And I'll just tell you, there's a little bit of a surprise in there. And there are some folks who worked on the original film that also work in this. So that's all I'll say. Those are the films.
Well, you've given us a great teaser with that last one, because we're like fully immersed in Kubrick, all things Kubrick on the show. So that's going to be pretty exciting. And what kind of guts does it take to make your own kind of sequel of sorts to 2001?
Well, gutsy they move. Got some. I don't want to give anything away, but Kubrick is maybe one of my very all-time favorites. Mm-hmm. And just when I saw that, when I saw that room, ooh, I'm like, what is this? And sure enough, it was what I thought it was.
I know,
cryptic, but again, I don't want to give spoilers.
Well, you know, Kubrick was cryptic too, so it's perfect. Perfect. So how many films in all? That sounded like something like 10. How many films?
I'd say a handful. It's 10-ish, yeah. Something like that. But it's 2 hours of films. So some of the films are 2 minutes long. Some of them are 18 minutes long. So.
And the doors open at 6:30, Los Angeles Film School, October 24th.
Yeah.
Our listeners, go to carnivalofdarkness.net. That'll give you all the information about the event and the panel that's participating and everything you need to know about Carnival of Darkness 3, the third year of this great event. Where do you see the event going from here? Like, in your wildest imagination, what do you want this to be years from now?
I'd like it to continue, just like we have Slam Dance and Sundance and Shriek Fest and Scream Fest. I'd like it to just be one of those. It's a name recognition film festival.
Yeah. Is the L.A. Film School, I've never been inside the L.A. Film School. I mean, I've seen it from across the street, because it's right across the street from, is it the Arclight? Is that where it is?
The Arclight, yes.
Yeah. That's a good venue, I would imagine.
It's a great venue. It's a THX-authorized, state-of-the-art theater with an enormous professional-grade screen. So it's a great place to see these films, too.
Yeah. Well, Alex, I wish you the best of luck.
Yeah,
and
we
really appreciate the fact that you've incorporated us into this this project, and it means a lot to us, and thank you for being so supportive of our show, really.
I also want to continue doing this with you guys and
announcing these selections
live, you know, even when I'm a big feature film muckety-muck. But you have big feature film muckety mucks coming there all the time, don't you?
We're going to hold you to that, Ben. I mean, I don't care. I don't care if you've just picked up an Oscar. You're still coming back to talk to us. Absolutely.
I will.
Thank you so much, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All righty, sir. Bye bye.
All right. Take care. Good night.
All right. Bye.
If you've missed any portion of Alex's announcements on who will be included in this year's Carnival of Darkness Festival, you can replay this show as soon as we go off the air. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Some of those sound really cool.
It's great to have a venue for short filmmakers and an audience that actually comes out to see specifically a short film. You know? I think that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
So in a little bit, Dean will be joining us. Dean called me yesterday with bad news.
Oh, God, what happened?
Well, he just got out of the Passion screening, the new De Palma movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, are you sitting down? And I was like, oh, my God, he met De Palma. He talked to De Palma, and De Palma's going to come back on our show, and it's going to be great. He said De Palma never showed up.
Oh.
He said, They said after the screening, they said he's delayed, it'll be 15 or 20 more minutes, and then finally they just had to cut the cord on it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah. Sad.
That is, yeah.
But he's seen a ton of movies, and he's going to report on them to us.
Okay, awesome. I'm really looking forward to hearing what he has to say.
Let me review a couple of things. I guess the Academy, that's the big news that came out.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, they've changed quite a few things in terms of the voting. I think the nominations are announced earlier. Is it 5 days earlier?
I thought, yeah, it sounded like it was. It's like right. It's before the actual Globes happen. So
yes,
like a week. I think it's what, a week before, like a little bit a week before the Globes are. The event goes on, so it's a big curiosity.
Yeah, and usually the Oscar nominations are announced like 3 days after the Globes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of kind of controversy in the press, the movie-related press,
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
they say, is this going to hurt the movies? The thinking being that they have to have their ballots back in by January 3rd.
Yeah.
And if that's like 10 days or whatever it is early, that's 10 fewer days that they have to actually see these movies. And some of these movies are going down to the wire. I think Les Mis is, I mean, they're going to be editing up till the last possible
mm-hmm.
minute. But generally, I mean, they hold Academy screenings all through the months of
mm-hmm.
November and December.
Yeah, they do.
There's countless opportunities to see a lot of these films. On top of that, a lot of these studios, probably now more than ever because the truncated deadline, they're going to be sending out tons of screeners to Academy members
mm-hmm.
so they can watch it from home. I don't necessarily see that that's going to have an effect. Here's another aspect of the thing that they've changed in terms of the voting. For the first year, it's going to go electronic.
How do you feel about this?
It's inevitable, and you know, on paper, it sounds like something that might be convenient.
I think it's a great idea, but is it full? I mean, this is going to be something where I don't think it's foolproof yet. I mean, that's my only problem with it. I just don't see. This is tricky now when you get to this kind of thing.
Yeah, are there going? Well, they no longer have to worry about hanging chads.
That's true. They no longer have to worry about that.
But the obvious concern, like the first thing people bring up is like, what about the older people that don't understand how to use computers? But there's still like a physical balloting process, too, for people that prefer it that way.
Right. Yeah, that's a good plan.
But here's another slant that they've given to this electronic voting thing. I don't know that this has any credence, but, you know, we'll see when the nominations come out. Will they nominate edgier, more youthful fare just by the nature of going electronic?
That's a good, very good question. I don't know. I was thinking, though, you got to forgive me for... I was just thinking there's a nominee that we haven't talked, a possible nomination we haven't talked about, but I think it is possible for Best Actor. I know it came out of nowhere, but
okay.
But speaking of youthful and edgy.
Oh, okay, you tied it
up. Tatum for Magic Mike.
Oh, okay.
I was just thinking that because I was thinking, you know, we talked about, you know, obviously, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis Lincoln, but then I was thinking, you know, Magic Mike made a lot of money, but also a lot of ripples. You know, I think his performance in that really many of the performances, but especially his, really like might be a breakthrough critically for him, and that could I see that as a possibility for some reason.
Well, if Channing Tatum gets nominated. Then you definitely know that the electronic voting process has inspired more youthful.
Yeah, because I was just thinking that, and the other thing to look, I mean, you might laugh at it now, but as a strong possibility is Jennifer Lawrence for The Hunger Games. I would not rule that out.
I think Jennifer Lawrence is getting the nomination, actually, for the Silver Linings Playbook.
Oh, I think she and maybe Bradley, too, for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, she's going to get a Best Actress nomination for that. But the Magic Mike player that I think does have an outside shot of a nomination for supporting is Matthew McConaughey.
Oh, yeah.
Because
out
of anyone in the film business this past year, creatively, I think Matthew McConaughey's had the best year.
True, very true.
Coming out with like back-to-back worthwhile projects that he really gets to
mm-hmm.
show off, and obviously Magic Mike, he gets to show off.
Well, yeah, that might not be the word you wanted.
Whole different sense,
there.
I was trying to think of an appropriate euphemism here,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's been a great year for him. I think that his Best Actor nomination will come next year because he's lost a ton of weight. He's looking terribly gaunt for this upcoming film he's doing about a lawyer who contracted AIDS in the 80s or something.
Oh, yeah, okay. All right, I got you.
In a big kind of dramatic role that just kind of has Oscar written all over it. But
mm-hmm.
I think that supporting is not out of the question for McConaughey. The Best Supporting Actor category is actually pretty crowded. Because I went through I went through Oscar category predictions insanely early.
Yeah, on Jason's show.
Yeah, and some of them were hard to fill out, and some of them were quite easy. I mean, there are too many contenders in some of these categories, but it's going to be an interesting year, and of course you always have to leave open the possibility of that late bloomer. It inevitably happens. December comes around and a movie comes out of nowhere, usually backed by Weinstein.
Like The Crying Game came out of nowhere when that came out, so that's the one I always think of. Or what was it? Or something like, even like Million Dollar Baby, for that matter, comes out of nowhere. You know, you didn't expect, I mean, they throw that out at the last minute. So.
There's bound to be like a last minute movie that it's much better than everyone anticipated, and all of a sudden that'll have the momentum. And then come February, that momentum would have dwindled a little bit. And everybody will say, well, I don't know if it's such a sure thing now. And it always happens year after year. It's the same thing.
Right.
Okay, New York Film Festival. It's time for our first live report from the New York Film Festival. And, of course, Dean is the man who is providing that to us. Dean, buddy, you're on the line. How are you, man?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm very good. So where are you standing at? The place where you're staying now, or are you standing at the actual film festival?
I'm in Brooklyn at the moment. I decided not to do this out on the street because so I'm not going with tradition. I decided to do it in the quiet of.
That's cool.
Well, I appreciate that, but let's pretend like you're at the you're actually standing in front of the film festival. Let's actually put
you
in a helicopter. Above the film festival. I'll make some helicopter noise, like you're live on the scene.
Well, you know, the film festival doesn't actually start until the 28th. So what we're having right now is the first real full week of critics screenings.
Okay.
So it's when you go to Lincoln Center, besides the obvious, you know, crowds that are around there, you know, every day. The film festival activity is not evident yet. So, what's also going on too in connection with the with press screenings is also they're having meetings with producers. It's the IFP. You've heard of the IFP, the Independent Film Production Project or whatever it is. I don't know what it stands for, but so. While we're in there watching movies, there's tons of filmmakers meeting with potential distributors and potential backers.
Good.
So,
I mean, that's essential for a festival, especially there's a few that have yet to be picked up, the most high profile of which for us personally is De Palma's film, has not yet been picked up. So, and I already revealed that he didn't show up.
Right.
I like to think he didn't show up because maybe he was in that meeting with the person that's going to buy and distribute Passion.
It's possible. I mean, you know, we were thinking, you know, after watching the film that maybe this was the final twist, you know, to the film. It's like maybe he was doing it as to add some mystery to the proceedings, but no, it didn't happen. We sat there and waited for about 20-25 minutes for him, and then finally they came up and said, "No go. It's not going to happen."
Wow.
So
well,
I mean,
that was the first movie
unavoidably detained. Yeah, that was the first movie that we watched. Passion, you know, Passion opened up with a beautiful score, and I was really hoping that it was who I was thinking it was, and I was right. It was Pino. Yeah. It opens up with the Pino Donaggio score.
Oh, cool.
When his name pops up on screen, you know, I felt like we were in good hands. Like from there on, you know. Passion is everything you want in a De Palma movie. It is wry. It is well crafted. It has all of those things that we love in De Palma movies. It has a masterful split screen segment.
Oh, cool!
It has playful uses of lenses and color. The film is actually it's actually color wise. It's actually split. It has dominant colors in each three of its acts. The first act is suitably for a movie called Passion is dotted with lots of reds and purples, and basically the film tells the story of a set of female executives at a German advertising company named Coke, K-O-C-H, and they are advertising a new smartphone, and Naomi Rapace plays a producer who's come up with a great idea for a commercial where they use the smartphone as an ass cam, they put it online. And it creates a tremendous stir, like where humorously I thought gets like something like 5 million hits in the space of 5 hours or something like that, and I thought that was funny, you know. So did the audience too. Everybody was having a terrific time with it. Anyway, Rachel McAdams plays her boss, a higher up, who actually steals the credit for the idea. She basically says, you know, you have the talent, but I made the best use of it. And she does this because she wants to move up in the company and go back to New York and leave Germany. And this opens up a whole can of worms, which includes Naomi Rapace sort of spiraling downwards into a sort of an addiction to sleeping pills. There's the wonderful revelation that, and I'm not giving anything away here, because I don't want to give anything away about the machinations of the plot. But there is a wonderful revelation about a twin sister. There's a twin sister somewhere in here, which, you know, us De Palma fans, you know, love the idea of the twin sisters because you know, so there's a little bit of sisters in this. There's a little bit of body double. There's a little, because there's a lot of kink involved in the film, a lot of kinky sex, though unfortunately no nudity. So there's a little bit of Dress to Kill involved. When the film moves over to its second act, it becomes all the passion is drained away, and it becomes the visuals become sort of dappled in this sort of icy blue feel. And this is at Naomi Rapace's sort of bottoming out period, and then the final act of the film is basically painted in blacks and browns. It's really wonderful. It's a remake of a film that was done about 3 years ago called Crime d'Amour, which starred Kristen Scott Thomas, and apparently wasn't nearly as interesting, from what I hear from the people who've seen it, wasn't nearly as interesting, mainly because there's another character that's involved here that is Naomi Rapace's assistant, and in the original film, the assistant was cast as a gay man, but in this film, it's cast as a woman that sort of has a crush on Naomi Rapace, and so that creates a whole other layer of intrigue in the film.
A couple of questions. Because, I mean, gosh, I'm so excited. We have another De Palma thriller.
Right, yeah.
I think it's the first one since Raising Kane, isn't it? Femme Fatale.
Yeah.
So So it's been 10 years or so since he's worked in this genre.
Right.
So when you see it begin, and it's clearly De Palma-esque, as we all know and love, and you see Pino's name and that romantic lush score, I can imagine it is, does it feel like you're in a time vault, in a way, as a De Palma fan?
Absolutely, absolutely. It is a it is an absolute 80s, I would say like a sort of a mid-80s throwback. It absolutely feels like you're watching this on Cinemax late at night. It's got, you know, it's got slinky saxophone on the score, you know, and everything is sort of steely and glassy in it, you know, there's times where you're confused about space and about time, That's also, you know, a De Palma sort of mainstay for his thrillers. I don't want to oversell it because, you know, I have to confess I like Femme Fatale a little bit more. I mean, but this is, or of course some of his classics. But I would definitely put it up there with something like, you know, Dress to Kill.
That's good enough.
That's quite a statement, man.
It was fun.
Awesome. That's great to hear.
And the DP on this one is Almodovar's DP, which
right.
I find exactly right. I find it exactly perfect for a De Palma thriller because when I see those, especially something like The Skin I Live In, I mean, and Almodovar has admitted as such that he loves De Palma. I see that kind of lunacy that I love in De Palma's thrillers. I think it's
perfect.
Yeah,
no question about it. I mean, it's what De Palma fans want, it's only a matter of time before it gets distribution. I mean, that's not going to be any kind of problem, I don't think.
Good. Okay, well, so what's next? What else did you have?
Well, next on the list was The Bay, which is Barry Levinson's foray into found footage horror territory, which is a genre that he's coming to rather late, I would say. This film takes place in a small town in Maryland, your backyard, Jerry.
Where in Maryland? Where they?
It takes place in Claridge, Maryland.
I've never heard of it. Oh my God!
On the Chesapeake Bay. And the film is sort of framed by the reports that are done by a newcomer to the news game. She's an inexperienced reporter who's sort of kind of learning on the job, and she finds herself. As the film begins, she's sort of narrating the film as somebody who's being interviewed for a documentary through Skype. The whole film is done as if it was completely taken from, you know, from news reports, from on the scene footage taken from people with cameras, also from closed circuit televisions and stuff like that. First of all, this way of making this movie—I mean, it doesn't really make much sense, really, because there's cameras in places where there wouldn't be cameras, and sometimes they just completely drop it because they know they can't cover it as you know, they just can't. They can't convince you that there are cameras in every place. So
right.
This is not entirely successful. I mean, in my opinion, well, let me just say, I hated the movie. I despised it. So you're going to get this immediately. This is part of their new midnight movie sort of sidebar that they have.
Right.
And anyway, the film is basically an ecological horror tale in which the water in the bay starts, and it's July 4th. It's, you know, the horror begins on a July 4th holiday. And the water in the bay starts having, you know, extremely, extremely adverse effects on every living thing, including, you know, there's a sea of dead fish and birds falling out of the sky, and of course, the effect on people, which is basically lots of vomiting of both of stomach contents and the blood.
I gotta stop bathing in the bay. Okay, thanks. All right, thank you for bringing this to my attention. All right.
Lots of boils and blisters, amputations, and well, I won't go into too much detail of what's causing it because really the movie only has two modes, really. It's really only about what's causing it, and we learn this pretty early on, what's causing it. And so the movie just keeps repeating and repeating and repeating itself. And then the other mode is, wow, look at all the dead bodies around here. Wow, there's dead bodies all over the place. That's the only two things that it does, really. It's never scary. Let me take that back. There is one really effective jump scare in it that really did get the audience, and it got me too. But it's also kind of, you know, I find those jump scares sort of like, it takes a certain amount of skill to do those, but it's also sort of cheap, in
right.
my opinion. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have any of the, you know, I mean, to me, the king of all ecological horror movies is the birds. Mm-hmm. And one great thing about the birds is you never know what causes it. What causes it is not interesting, you know. That's not what we're interested in. I think, you know, maybe in the age of news, you know, 24-hour news, maybe it's seen as being something that we care about or whatever, but the horror from the birds and from the most, you know, there's tons of ecological horror movies. I mean, you could even say Jaws is one. But the horror of those things comes from not knowing what causes it, and then just forgetting about that. I mean, explaining it is just boring.
Right, I got you.
There's a lot of really poor acting in this movie too. I mean, the only person that comes out of it unscathed, as far as an acting goes, is a gentleman who's playing the mayor of the town, who might be culpable in the cause of the disaster, and he's pretty good in it, but the lead is ineffective and not, you know, not interesting. The movie is very rarely funny. I don't find it. I mean, I guess I'm just wrong. I know there's a lot of people who like to see a lot of gore, and the gore itself is entertainment enough. But for me, it's just nothing. It's just makeup effects or whatever. I mean, so what? You know, I mean, I don't find that scary or anything. There's nothing scary about that. So, and then finally, I just want to say this. Why is it that it's a very rare movie that can get right the actual feel of television reporting. You know, the anchors on in movie versions of television news, the anchors and the reporters, they always feel phony. I mean, it's like 0.001% gets it right. And this is a movie that I think really really wants to convince you that it's gone the extra mile to get everything right, but they can't even get this right, and this is the whole basis of the film. Plus, it's being directed by and co-written by Barry Levinson, who, you know, like him or not, you know, I mean, some people, I've had a discussion with some other critics outside, and we talked about, you know, how some people, you know, truly dislike Barry Levinson. And I said, well, nobody dislikes, you know, diner or whatever, or a lot of his screenplays that he did early in his career, or even things like Tin Man and Avalon. But I think, you know, maybe later on in his career, or maybe with things like, you know, The Natural or Rain Man are maybe seen as a little corny, and corniness is sort of the kiss of death for a certain, you know, group out there. So, but you know, there would be no reason that you would look at this movie and go, yeah, this is a Barry Levinson movie. There's absolutely... There's no sense of his involvement in it, and there is no sense of why he would be interested in doing this. I mean, this is the guy that just did You Don't Know Jack on HBO.
Mm-hmm.
He's still doing good movies. It's still within his grasp to do good movies. I don't see why he would have to stoop this low to, like, you know, to remain relevant or whatever. I mean, why would you care?
You know, I thought it was weird. I think it's kind of speaks to what you're saying, that it doesn't feel like a Levinson film, that none of the performances stand out. I mean, because in all, most, the vast majority of his films, I mean, you can at least rely on great performances
right.
to pop up. I think that this movie was probably... a last-minute thing that he wanted to work on, because he tried to get Gotti going, and Gotti kept getting stalled.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he just went to this because it was probably quick and it was there. That's my feeling. And he's done that other times in his career, not in his genre, but, you know, Wag the Dog was, like, shot in 2 weeks or whatever,
mm-hmm.
or 3 weeks. So who knows?
Well, he definitely had more luck with Wag the Dog, that's for sure.
yeah.
I guess there's probably an audience out there for it, and God bless them, go and see it. I turned to my friend, Tony Diube, who does a great website called Cinema Viewfinder and actually also writes for The House Next Door. He's an Atlanta native. He knows Aaron. So we always meet up here when we come to the festival, and it's always great to see him because I don't get to see him in Atlanta very much. I turned to him, and I was just absolutely ridiculously angry when it was all over, because, A, I would prefer not to see a movie like this. This is a movie that I go around the corner, down the block, and through the woods to avoid, okay?
I hear you.
Because I don't want any of this stuff in my head, and I don't want to waste my time on it. But I especially don't spend my own money and even the show's money to come up to the New York Film Festival when I could be watching Life of Pi and sit here and watch this piece of shit. And it is a piece of shit.
I want to watch the Life of Pi.
You know, I just don't understand why they would even put this in the critics' screening. Because it has absolutely no appeal to, 99% of the critics there who, you know, I mean, there's probably, you know, I'm serious, 99% of them are just, are interested in much more highbrow stuff.
Well, this sounds like something that'll probably make it to VOD. I mean,
yeah,
that's probably where we'll see this.
Yeah, that's a good call. Now, wait, did you have a choice between this and Life of Pi? That's what I want to know.
No, I mean, it's just a sort of, it's a continuing problem that I have with just how they have programmed the critics' screenings. I mean, they've got, you know, some good stuff all lumped together over here, and then there's, 6 days of, you know, stuff that's like, okay, well, I mean, I'm sure it might be good, but... you know, where's the good stuff, the stuff that people want to hear about, you know, and they have that stuff. I mean, the thing is, the critic screenings are ridiculously long. I mean, given that the festival itself is – just a little less than 2 weeks. The critic screenings take 4 weeks to go through, Monday through Friday, from 9 o'clock in the morning, all the way up until usually about 4, and then you're just like, why would you have this? I just don't know. I don't get it.
I mean, I got to be honest. From what I read about it and just what you've told me, I never had high hopes for it. And I do like Barry Levinson, but I just got to say, I'd rather go back and watch Bandits again.
Exactly.
Let me ask you, is On the Road screening for the critics?
No, it's not even part of the festival.
Oh, my God. Really? Okay.
No, it's not part of the festival. They didn't select it, even as a sidebar thing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's not part of the main slate, which I guess that means that those people, you know, most of the people who do the selection are the people who write for and edit film comment. So I can only assume that they didn't.
Well, I mean, if you didn't find The Bay effective, I think you'll like. Barry Levinson announced that he's going to make a sequel to it. He announced it just the other day, and he promised it would be scarier. It's called The Michael Bay, and I think that
or Old Bay.
I think it'll be more effective. Yeah, just talk about an ecological disaster.
Seriously. Well, the next movie that we saw that day is much better, and it's one that the show has a history with a certain way, and that's Marina Zenovich's sequel to Roman Polanski Wanted and Desired. It's called Roman Polanski Odd Man Out. And as you would expect, this is a very, very effective sequel. You know, she's a filmmaker that actually went into this notion of making a film about Roman Polanski, thinking that it was going to be a short film. You know, and here it is, 7 years after she first went out on this journey. And in some ways, as she says early on in the film, she's the narrator, she says that, she's been sort of imprisoned in making this film, just like, you know, he's been imprisoned by just this whole affair, you know, for 30 years or whatever. The film begins with her talking about, you know, the release of Wanted and Desired, and how, you know, the release of that film actually engendered some new interest in Roman Polanski, and how she and bringing him to justice in America, and how she felt sort of culpable and a little guilty about that, you know, because, of course, and she has no reason to feel guilty, first of all. I mean, you know, she did this with the best of intentions and did a wonderful job of highlighting an obvious travesty of justice. But As the film begins, you know, Polanski is going out, as we remember, is going out to get an award for a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Zurich Film Festival in Switzerland. And when he does that opens up a whole series of machinations that involve not only the U.S. Justice Department and particularly the L.A. District Attorney's Office, who are all just like that original judge, you know, that was in the first film, who are all trying to make a name for themselves in one way or another. It doesn't just involve that, though. One thing that the film brings up is that there's also something going on with the Swiss government in the wake of the 2008, you know, economic collapse that affected pretty much the entire world, not just us. Apparently, you know, they came up with the idea of, you know, extraditing Polanski back to the U.S. as a way of appeasement, because the U.S. was actually asking the Swiss government to turn over millions and maybe even billions of dollars of unpaid taxes that were owed on almost 5,000 Swiss bank accounts. And so this was looked at as sort of a way to appease that, you know, having to hand over all of that cash. Sort of a weird sort of connection there. I mean, she makes a really good case for this being the case. I don't know that that is true, but it certainly could be true. But the film, you know, follows Polanski as he's put under house arrest. And you know, you think, well, you know, being under house arrest in a Swiss show, you know, of course he was in jail, in an actual jail for a little while, where he says he was well taken care of in a very, very moving final scene in the film. But also, you know, you see him, you know, spirited away to this beautiful Swiss chalet that they have, he and his wife, Emmanuel Signier. I have to say, I mean, you know, I feel that the guy is just bedeviled with tragedy, and nothing says that more than just there's this great photo. I guess, you know, she found this incredible photo taken by one of the many paparazzi outside of the Swiss chalet, which, by the way, is a absurd sort of surreal thing going on there too. Just this chalet is in the middle of nowhere, and here's all these, you know, mountains all around. It's beautiful. And anyway, this one shot of Polanski just sort of peeking out of the window, just like a ghost or something, you know. And it's just, to me, it's heartbreaking, you know. I mean, here's this 76-year-old director. Yes. Displayed bad judgment, but was told by the judge way back in 76 or wherever it was that, look, you know, the charge is unlawful sexual intercourse. It wasn't rape. That's what it was. It was unlawful sexual intercourse. That was the actual charge. And the judge told him that this was the deal, but the judge went back on it after the DAs went in there and talked him out of it. And that's not how the justice system is supposed to work. So that's what this issue is, you know.
So, but two questions. The first film she chose, she had the option, but she chose not to interview Polanski on camera. Is he on camera in this one?
He is on camera, but he's not interviewed by her.
Okay.
I did have an opportunity to ask her. She was interviewed by Skype, and I did. And she asked, by the way, that anyone who had a question, please identify themselves or who they're with and so forth. So I did. I asked the second question, and my question was, and when I mentioned Movie Geeks United, she gave a smile. I know that there's, Jamie, you want to say something about, you know.
No, I mean, she was on the show to talk about the original, but she was actually driving on the way to Sundance when she called to talk about the original. And then we spoke to Brett Ratner, who was producing the sequel, at least at the time, and we spoke to him actually the day that Polanski was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what led to it being covered on international news, that snippet from our show where he's talking about he's putting together another Polanski documentary with Marina, and this time we're going to try to get him on camera, and we're going to set the record straight. That's really about the justice system. And so what question did you ask?
Well, I asked her, you know, I mean, given that she says in, on the outset she refers to feeling guilty about, you know, even making the first film in some ways, I wondered, you know, well, wondered if she had gotten over that guilt and whether she had any sense that that Polanski had any blame for her. And she was very, you know, political about her answer to that. Mm. She basically sort of left it at, you know, my relationship with Polanski is extremely, extremely complicated.
Wow.
Mm. Huh.
And
interesting.
And she sort of left it at that. I mean, as far as her guilt, whether she still feels guilt, she says that she's done with this phase of her career. She's ready to, you know, she said her child has, you know, said that she needs to go and do a romantic comedy now. When in fact she's doing another documentary about another famous person with the initials RP. She's doing a documentary about Richard Pryor.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
And she's about to enter the editing stages of that. So, but she is happy with the way the film, this particular film, Odd Man Out, you know, sort of wraps up the entire affair. Which, by the way, as a film, you know, some of the interviewees in the film say that they think that it's something that's never going to go away. You know, that this has no end. That you're talking about two forces that absolutely refuse to compromise in any way, shape, or form.
That doesn't include the victim.
Yes.
I mean, because the victim wants it all behind her. She just wants to end it. I mean, stop the kind of the threats of arrest and stop the extradition threats and just leave it be.
And in this film, we actually get her, but we also talk to the mother, I think, for the first time.
Oh, wow.
In
wow.
this film. So the filmmaker actually travels to Hawaii, where the mother is living, and interviews her, and it's interesting. The mother has a very sort of jovial sort of feel, and it made one of the critics ask a question about, like, this referred to the woman as being a silly woman or whatever, and Marina took a exception to that. She said she's not a silly woman. She is somebody that likes to laugh, and I. You know, I did try and direct her, you know, not to, but not overbearingly so. I just, you know, I captured her like she actually is. And, but she did capture her at a point where where the mother actually couldn't say Roman Polanski's name. And the director from behind the camera said, "What, you can't say his name? I mean, come on, try and say it right now." And the mother just couldn't do it. But as far as the daughter goes, Samantha and her husband are way past being over this. That said, Samantha is writing a book about her experiences with this. Now, you would say, well, if she's really over this, why would you be going to write a book? Well, the reason for that is, if anybody ever asks about it ever again, she can always say, "Look, it's in the book. It's it.
Right.
I'm never talking about it ever again."
Right, right.
So I can see where somebody would want to write a book. I mean, besides, you know, any kind of financial gain or whatever.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, that's a major coup to get the mother involved, because she's bore a lot of brunt of blame too. It's like what mother would, because the mother is the person that dropped her off.
Right.
If I remember correctly, like, what kind of mother would do that? Or, you know, so her behaviors have been called into question too. But this is my final question about this, and then we can move to the other movies. you know, you say some people say there's no end, but in terms of just the movie, does it feel like it reaches some sort of resolution?
I feel like the Polanski's number one concern in all of this is to and at least this chapter of his life is really to protect his marriage, which he's been happily married to Ms. Seignier for a little while now. I think almost 20 years, if not exactly 20 years. And they have two children, and he wants to protect that life. He's very happy with that life. He's not going around, you know, with two Playboy bunnies on his arm like he was in the 60s anymore. So I think for him, being restored to, and I think it should be for us too, being restored to that life and being allowed to live out the rest of his life in that way and still making movies occasionally, is happy as it's going to get, really. I mean, so yes, I guess so. But the last scene of the movie, which I'm not going to tell you what it is, but it's extremely moving. It's extremely moving, and it does involve a statement from Roman Polanski.
I hope HBO picks this up, just
yes,
like we picked up the last one. Yeah.
Yeah, it's excellent.
Okay, so your next one.
Well, the next one I'm not going to spend too much time on. It's a German movie. It's called Barbara. It's by I can't even remember the filmmaker's name now because I kind of found this movie a little dull. Christian Petzold is his name. It's his fifth movie with his lead actress named Nina Foss, and she plays sort of a sulky, sort of disintegrated doctor. This takes place in East Germany in 1980, and she's been incarcerated by the East German government, and she's been released, and as punishment, she's been sent to a remote pediatric hospital, where she strikes up two important relationships. One with a doctor that at first seems to resent her and to be sort of over picky about her methods, but then when he sees that she does have even though she's very closed off by because of her incarceration, she seems a little traumatized by that. She does come to life when she comes in contact with her patients who really respond to that, and she strikes up a relationship with a female patient who's pregnant, and it's probably the most touching part of the movie. But unfortunately for me, this movie is one of those foreign films that is way too slow. I mean, it's like, and also for me, not enough happens in it. Sometimes when I'm watching foreign films, I feel like there's too much time spent on what some screenwriters call shoe leather, and that is people walking from one place to another, or people riding a bike from one place to another, or people driving a car from one place to another. And this is just sort of like, look, I know it's East Germany in 1980, not the happiest place in the world, but also nobody is ever smiling. I mean, it's a tough world to imagine where no one ever smiles and everyone carries a frown everywhere they go. And it just doesn't, for me, doesn't ring real now. And so it's one of those movies that just, I feel like it would have been better as a short or something like that, because it could have easily been done in, 30 minutes, and it would have been a very effective short. So that aside, it's called Barbara, and you probably won't see it at a theater near you anytime soon.
speaking of endless shots of people driving, I saw a movie that had far too much of that this weekend. It's called Birdemic.
I've heard of this film.
it's achieved a degree of infamy now because it's so damn bad. But there's
that's something that I still want to see one of these days. Is it worth it? I mean, even as a bad movie?
I mean, if you get a kick out of watching, like, really awful. I mean, this is worse than The Room.
Yeah.
It's just bad, bad, bad. But
you need with those movies, you need more than a six-pack. You need, like, a 12-pack or a case or whatever, you know, a case of beer.
Well, at least two
or three other fellow bad movie lovers in the room with you.
That's exactly the only way to enjoy it.
Right.
That's exactly what we had Saturday night when we all watched it together. But if they cut out all the scenes of driving and walking from one place to another, the movie would be at least 20 minutes shorter. And that is no lie. I mean, they spent so much time. Okay, so your next one. Your next one was the Bill Murray one, right?
Yeah, the next one is Hyde Park on Hudson, directed by Roger Mitchell, starring Bill Murray as Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who's in the beginning of the pre-war stage of his presidency. And he's ensconced in an idyllic, you know, country house. So this doesn't take place at the White House or in Washington or anything like that. It's in his country estate, where he strikes up, even though Eleanor is with him, Eleanor is played by Olivia Williams.
Oh, really? Okay.
And she really does recall, without looking exactly like her, she does recall Eleanor Roosevelt quite a bit. Olivia Williams is Eleanor, but he strikes up a dalliance with his fifth cousin, that's played by Laura Linney, and Laura Linney is a sort of cloistered away innocent that hardly knows at the beginning of the movie, has hardly met Roosevelt before. And she's been busy taking care of her mother, who's been sick for many years, and she's sort of been shut away, kind of. And her relationship with Roosevelt opens up her world. That is part of the movie, though. That's only part of the movie. The other part of the movie, which was a surprise to me, is the involvement of the same two characters that led The King's Speech, which was, of course, the King and the Queen.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have Samuel West playing King George, and Olivia Colman, who was in Tyrannosaur a year or so ago.
Mm-hmm.
Olivia Colman playing the Queen. They're visiting America, visiting Roosevelt, in order to sort of repair what's been sort of a damaged relationship between the two countries, and in order to get Roosevelt's okay to back them in the war that's coming up, and the only glimpse of Hitler that we have in this movie, by the way, is on a stamp that's in FDR's stamp collection that he uses he brings out in order to impress the girls and get
right.
them to sleep with him. Let me just say this about this movie. These two stories that are going on at the same time don't meld well together at all. They seem very independent of each other and don't seem connected really in any other way except by happenstance. As far as Bill Murray goes, you know, that's the main reason that, you know, everybody's interested in this. The shame to me is that it's not Bill Murray. Bill Murray's good in the movie and everything. He's fine in it. But there are times where he almost takes a back seat to the characters of the King and the Queen. And, of course, we have the stuttering that comes up again. At this time, of course, George had not conquered the stuttering problem. So here we have two leaders of state that have an affliction of a certain sort, and I think they find a common bond in that. And And they have one major scene together, these two guys. Actually, their relationship is quite sweet in the movie. It's quite well done. And Samuel West does an excellent job. You got to give it to an actor that goes and takes a part that was just in the movie theaters, and some other guy won an Oscar playing the same part, and he still attacks it with as much aplomb as West does here. He's really good in the movie, and he does make the role his own, even though that movie is still fresh in our minds. But there's just not enough, for me at least, there's not enough of an emphasis on Bill Murray's character, or even for that matter, Laura Linney's character, or even Eleanor's character for that matter. It's all just sort of lost in there. Almost everything just sort of seems free-floating and lost. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, the movie is pleasant. It's widescreen. It's very well art directed, as you might imagine. But it's also sort of a movie for old ladies, really.
Yeah.
And it has some funny moments, and it's got a little bit of charm in there. But I don't see this movie as being anything that is going to engender a lot of Oscar love or anything like that, even though on the surface it seems like, oh, Bill Murray is FDR. I mean, he's a good actor. You think, oh, this is going to be great. It's just not that. It's not going to happen. He's almost a supporting actor in the film.
So you wouldn't put him as, because when we discussed it last week before you'd seen it, we thought that Bill Murray might get nominated, but you wouldn't say that now after seeing it.
No.
Okay.
It's one of those movies that, just like every year, it's one of those movies that when you hear about it on the slate, back in in March or whatever, you think, oh, that's going to be a player, but then it's going to come out.
This won't be even released on December 7th too. Interesting.
Yeah, I just don't see that as something that's going to happen.
So on December 7th, they're dropping another bomb.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call it a bomb. It's going to appeal to a certain crowd, and I can see it, playing at someplace in Lincoln Center, or at the Terra Theater down in Atlanta, to a very grateful sort of elderly crowd.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So There's one more next that was part of the festival slate.
Right. The last film that I saw today was, and I'll keep this quick because it's called Leave It Ingmar, and it's a beautiful, moving documentary. And the filmmaker's name, I have to look his name up because I can't really pronounce it, but Dheeraj Akhalar. It's from Norway. I think he's an Indian director, actually. It is basically a one-woman show in this, except for the film clips, of course. And we don't hear Ingmar Bergman's voice at all, really, in it. We see his image, but we don't hear his voice. We also see we hear his words through somebody who's reading some of his letters, and we get an intimate view of Ingmar Bergman's world. And what I mean by that is the house that he built on Faroe Island in Sweden, that was the same island that he filmed, some of his movies like Persona and Shame on. It's a beautiful sort of modern house, we do get to see Ingmar Bergman's, his videotape collection and all of his letters and everything, the bear that he kept as a child, the little teddy bear that he kept as a child, which is a very moving thing that happens towards the end of the movie. But basically, this is a one-woman show with Liv Ullmann being very candid, very intimate about their extremely complicated but very long relationship, which started out as a professional relationship with Persona, then quickly moved into a romantic relationship, which actually morphed into sort of a, well, for Lee Ullman, it sort of morphed into a sort of a situation where she was dealing with loneliness to the point where, I mean, she and Ingmar Bergman had had a child together, but were sometimes left behind because, at least emotionally, if not also physically, because, you know, he was away either working on a film or actually away, you know, in his head working on a film, you know. So he wasn't really there for her at this point. And then it also, then it morphed into a sort of a situation of like, well, a little bit of a torture kind of thing, you know, where he begins to sort of resent her for his own reasons, you know. For her, it seems like a mystery, but for so why this would happen, but you know, in a lot of scenes in those movies, like Hour of the Wolf and Shame and Passion of Anna, there's in the filming of a lot of those scenes, you know, he was putting her at great danger and great you know, I mean, you know, they had to go out in the middle of the Swedish sea and go and film this scene in the winter time with Liv Ullmann and Max von Sydow in this boat, and they're in the boat, a little tiny boat, and they have no, they're told not to wear any coats or anything. Meanwhile, she shows a picture of what, now look at Ingmar. She's pointing to Ingmar Bergman, and he's got like 10 coats on. He looks like, you know, he's like, look, he's got, I mean, he looks huge, you know, in this photo. And there they are in the boat, and they're just sort of there shivering, and that's what he wanted. And there's another scene where she was told to, like, go and get close. There's something burning. There's a house burning in the background, and he's told, he tells her to get closer to the fire, get closer, and get closer. And she said, I would have gone into that fire if Ingmar had told me to go into the fire. But then you see the footage, and the flames are just licking at her body, you know, and it's just so. But then of course, it morphs into a situation where they break up, you know, and she's free of him. But she always has, they always have sort of, they both have a desire to be with each other, you know, but it just can't happen. There's just something keeping it from happening. And then, then of course the film goes into their lifelong, you know, after they've each gotten over the relationship and they have a lifelong friendship that goes on to at least the end of Ingmar Bergman's life. She's very frank, not only just about her relationship with Bergman, but also about her Hollywood career, which had some successes, but not many. And she still looks absolutely beautiful, and has a completely wonderful spirit. The film is, she's not speaking in, well, she's Norwegian, but she's not speaking in Swedish, so it's English language. So, and the film's beautifully shot. If there's any one negative I would say about the film itself, is that it's, you know, sometimes a little lushly scored, which seems a little strange for a movie about Bergman and Liv Ullmann, because the movie doesn't need any kind of score to tell us how to feel, because it's already moving enough. But it's a beautiful movie. I hope that it appears on something like IFC. You know, because everybody deserves a chance to see it. Wonderful use of clips and so forth that will introduce you to a lot of Bergman stuff that you may not have seen. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's really terrific.
Okay, finally, before we close off tonight, I just read, I haven't been able to verify this because he hasn't posted it on his website yet. I don't know where this person got this, but I just read that Roger Ebert gave The Master 2.5 stars, and Roger Ebert's somebody that overpraises movies more than the opposite.
Wow.
I mean, he gave Arbitrage 4 stars.
interesting.
And I saw Arbitrage.
I read David Edelstein's review in New York Magazine tonight, and that was, I would say, probably a 2.5-star review. He was kind of lukewarm towards it, so
yeah.
It's not...
I mean, Edelstein's not known as somebody that overpraises movies.
No, he doesn't overpraise anything. I mean, but...
So, Dean, what did you think of it?
Well, I went to go see it in 70mm. I think it might be one of the only, certainly one of the only 70mm prints that's around, that's available for people to see. I saw it near Lincoln Center. And I saw it after a day of seeing not only three of the movies that I just mentioned, but also went to go see Hope Springs right before it, too. So I'd just seen four movies. By the way, I loved Hope Springs. I thought it was terrific.
Yeah.
Really great screenplay on that. So then I went right on into The Master. So I should have been, like, completely, like, wiped out, you know?
Yeah, no, that's quite a day. I mean...
Yeah. I should have been completely wiped out, but... It really doesn't take very long to get into The Master. I mean, once you see the first shot of it, I mean, this movie is, first of all, just have to say this, magnificently, magnificently filmed, photographed. And I wish I could pronounce the guy's name who photographed it. I don't have it in front of me. But
like Millay or something. He's Coppola's DP.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, I mean, the photography in this thing is just outstanding from the moment the movie pops up. Now, also, there's the Johnny Greenwood score, which is, there's a lot more of it than there was in There Will Be Blood. And if you remember famously with There Will Be Blood, that was one of the Oscar nominations. It was denied because... apparently, a lot of the music that was used in it had been previously written by Greenwood for something else. So
right.
He was, but I think that's going to change this year. The film, first of all, you've got Joaquin Phoenix playing Freddie Quell, who I did not know this about the story. I have kept away from looking at what the story is really about, but he's obviously affected by some, mental afflictions, to the point where he's first seen as in the military, and he's been put on a ship that's specifically set out to keep people who are soldiers that are, mentally deficient in some way. And so the first part of the movie, first, 15 minutes of the movie deals with, his life on the military and so forth. And then it moves on to his civilian life as a photographer. Now, these are the scenes that really, really kill you. When you see he's playing a photographer for a department store. He's a photographer for a department store like Sears or something.
Right.
And you see the portraits that come up. These portraits are absolutely unbelievable in their allegiance to what portraits of that era actually look like. And it's absolutely impossible. This was the moment that I said, okay, this movie is going to blow me away now. I just feel like it's going to blow me away. This is even before Hoffman comes into the picture as Lancaster Dodd. Once he does come into contact with Lancaster Dodd, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, the sort of stand-in for L. Ron Hubbard, once Hoffman comes into the picture, it's to some extent sort of taken over by Hoffman. At least, intermittently, let's put it that way. They are co-leads in the movie, by the way. There's no way that you could cast Hoffman as being a supporting actor, just like I suspected. They are co-leads.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a stunning sequence in the film. Lancaster Dodd, takes a shine to Joaquin Phoenix's character because... Phoenix, who's that character, is an alcoholic who makes his own alcohol, he makes this alcohol for Lancaster Dodd, and it endears him to Dodd, and that's their first sort of connection. Once that's out of the way, then Dodd sort of in the greatest scene in the movie, Dodd starts grilling Joaquin Phoenix about giving him the same sort of treatment that he gives anybody that's coming into his fold, and it involves a series of probing questions that are asked over and over again, to the point where he asks Joaquin Phoenix to answer these questions without blinking, and if you blink, then we have to start back over.
Right.
And you have to answer the same questions over and over again, and it forces Freddie Quell, Phoenix's character, to actually dredge up some hurts of his past. And so basically, don't mistake this movie for being a movie about Scientology. The Scientology aspect of it is just there to tell a story about one man's loneliness, his quest to overcome a hurt that has affected him his entire adult life, and that's what the entire movie is about. The Scientology aspect of it is interesting, and sometimes it overtakes the movie to the point where there is about a 20-minute period in there where Freddie Quell is putting up a lot of resistance to this process. And Lancaster Dodd goes and decides once and for all to break him. And it becomes sort of a brainwashing sort of segment of
right.
the film. And it gets a little confusing and a little... But it's supposed to be. I mean, the character of Freddie Quell is confused by it. It's supposed to be breaking him down. Basically, that's the entire film, is this battle between this one guy who wants this guy, this one megalomaniac who wants this guy's soul for his collection, and another guy that refuses to give his soul to anybody except the person that he really wants to give his soul to, which is his soul mate. He's looking for a soul mate. And he thinks he might have found it in Lancaster Dodd, and he does have affection for this character. They do have a true friendship, and, right up to the end, But... But he just can't give. This is not what he's about,
Okay.
Just put it that way.
It sounds fascinating.
It is. It is a journey. It's 2 hours and 15 minutes long. It never feels overlong. What I'm going to say is that you definitely feel like you have gone into some sort of like. I mean, it's not a snack. It's a full meal. It's like two meals. It's just absolutely. I thought it was absolutely wonderful. I mean, just a visual treat on top of the fact that it's just a two fascinating characters, and plus Amy Adams, who's. I've never seen Amy Adams actually be scary, but she's actually scary in this movie because she plays, Lancaster Dodd's wife, and she's like the true believer that has sort of written Freddie Quell off and sees him for what he really is, and counsels her husband to not waste any more time on this character. And she's absolutely stunning in it. So it's another feather in her cap. She's just amazing how she comes out. She's just the go-to woman for any kind of, just absolutely moving, supporting actress role out there,
Yeah.
It's
well,
great.
Jerry and I will have seen it by the time we return on Sunday.
I'm definitely trying to go see it this weekend, so definitely.
So I'm sure there'll be a lot more discussion on The Master then. So thank you, Dean. Tomorrow you take in some more movies and Friday, and then you'll be back with us on Sunday to give your additional reports on some of the films you've seen there, including Noah Baumbach's latest with Greta Gerwig.
Also Sunday night. Tomorrow.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
You'll have to tell me how that goes. So also Sunday night, a great film that I urge everyone to go see. It opens in New York this weekend. It opens in L.A. the weekend after. It's called Brooklyn Brothers Beat the Best. I think this is like the sleeper film of the year. It's such a genuine, funny, moving, eccentric movie that I'm highly recommending. The two stars, one of which is the writer-director of the film, will be with us on Sunday. Saturday night, we'll post our Diane Ladd interview.
Ooh.
And an additional Lynch series interview. So two Lynch series interviews coming Saturday. And then we'll in the coming week, we'll post our nearly hour-long interview with composer Christopher Young. So we got some good stuff coming up. But until then, Sunday night at 6, guys.
All right. Well,
right.
I'll
awesome.
Be there.
All right. Awesome.
All right. Thank you, guys. It's been an exciting night. We close with a score by a gentleman named Nathan First for the movie Act of Valor. Act of Valor.
There you go.
All right.
All right.
Guys.
All
good
right.
Night.
See you later.
Good night.